Special thank you to the college students that are here. Thank you. Okay. Listen, this morning, Ray talked about sort of two doors, like divorce or staying miserably married, right? And we want to talk tonight about something that we have been kicking around for a while, but never really talked on before this year in a formal sense, and that's intentional friendship in marriage. Before, when we meet couples that say, you know, we want to split because we love each other, we're just no longer friends. Then there are the committed Christians who are going to stay true to the covenant, and they say, we're going to stay faithful to the covenant, we just don't like each other, so we'll just stay miserably married and we'll live parallel lives. And what strikes us is what's missing in both of those is friendship. And our observation from a lot of couples that are getting into relationship is many couples get quickly into the physical expression and romance, chemistry. And so they're just caught up in how good this feels, how intimate it feels, but they never become friends because they're making out on the second date. And once you start making out, you can't become a friend. It doesn't work that way. So then there's the other side. You go after this, all this chemistry and stuff that's keeping you together sort of dwindles a little bit. Children come, aging, fagging, all this sort of stuff. And for men, and not true in our marriage. But anyway, that's another talk, which we won't give tonight. But here, don't lose me here. This is good. So when the sexual part sort of wanes in a marriage and they don't have friendship, they don't have anything, right? So we want to talk tonight about 8 points in how to really maintain friendship, to develop it and maintain it in your marriage. So let's pray. Father, thanks for giving us relationships. Thanks for coming up with this great idea called marriage. And we ask that you will help us to honor you in that. In Christ's name, amen. First, study. Continue to be a student of your spouse. 1 Peter 3:7 says, for the husbands are to live with their wives in an understanding way. We are to be students of each other as husbands and wives. So the first question really here is, how well do you know your spouse?
I want to see, any of you college students in a relationship have a boyfriend or a girlfriend? Raise up your hand. Okay. Does anybody have to remind you to pay attention to what Tyler likes or to give preference to him or to think about him a lot? Anybody have to remind you of that? No, exactly. So there was another hand up there, wasn't there?
Her hand just went down.
Yeah.
There went the discussion part of the evening.
The point was that it just comes pretty naturally. Nobody has to say, make sure that you're not selfish. Make sure you're thinking about him. It just really comes naturally. Our daughter was dating a guy this fall in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And when she came home from Christmas, she said, we said, so how did Christmas go? She'd only been dating him for about 4 weeks at that time. And she said, oh, it was really, we had a great time. Came over one night before I left. And she said, I wasn't sure if he was going to bring me a Christmas present or not. And so I got something for him, and I wrapped it, and I left it in my bedroom thinking, well, if he brings me something, I'll go up and get it, you know. And so
he said, what was it? And she said, he brought me an onion slicer.
Yeah.
And as a romantic man, dad, I just go, you cut your loss. But I'm a clear observer, and she seemed kind of happy about it. She's an onion slicer, you know, just a big smile. And I said, well, tell me more. And she said, well, we had a group of FCA people over a few weeks before that, and Chris came as I was fixing dinner, and I was cutting onions, and I was crying, and I said, I hate cutting onions.
Oh.
Whoa! And he just went way up, because here's a guy who was listening. He said, ah, she doesn't like cutting onions. I can get her something. And that was it. So, you know, it just came naturally. Chris, of course, trying to impress and win and connect with Lisa, was listening to everything. Onions make you cry. I'll get you an onion slice. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we were kind of impressed with him, although onion chopper, no, that didn't go
it
anywhere.
It wasn't enough.
It takes more than yes. But actually, that caused us to start thinking about our own relationship and about the many couples that come to us for counseling, realizing that for many, many couples, this is an area of great oversight or neglect in marriage. What comes very naturally to us early on ceases to be natural, and if we're not intentional about it, it's going to leave our marriages. It reminded us, actually, of our pre-marriage. Paul and I dated for a couple years before we got married, and our very first date is a great illustration of this very point. We'd been becoming friends probably 8 months into this. We'd almost consider each other best friends. There really wasn't a romantic thought on my part at that point. But one day I got a typewritten invitation in the mail. Now, for some of you, you'll need to Google that when you go home and find out what a typewriter is. Paul invited me to the finest restaurant in San Diego, the finest company, and he picked me up at my parents' house at 7 o'clock on Friday night. I was so excited about this date. This clearly marked the turn in our relationship from friendship into something more. He arrived at my parents' house in his 55 Ford station wagon, which was old even then. And as he walked me to his car and opened the door, he said, there's just one thing I'm going to ask. He said, I'd like to blindfold you because I don't want you to see where we're going. Now, college students, never get in the car with somebody who wants to blindfold you unless you know them very, very well. And at this point, I knew Paul could be trusted, and I said, sure, I guess. And he blindfolded me. Off we drove in his 55 Ford station wagon, making only one brief stop on the way to our ultimate destination, at which point Paul said, hang on for just a minute. I have to run in and get something that I forgot. Now, had I paid attention, I would have realized that was a harbinger of many things that would eventually come. But I was smitten with the guy, so I just kind of let that one drift right on past my blindfolded mind, and off we continued. Eventually, we get somewhere, and Paul pulls the car to a stop, and he said, keep the blindfold on. I have to make sure our reservations are ready. I could hear him pulling things out of the car. I had no idea what was going on. But about 15 minutes later, he came and he opened my door, and he said, keep the blindfold on still. We're not quite there. He led me by the elbow to a place, and then he took off the blindfold. And we were standing on Sunset Cliffs in North San Diego. Some of you know exactly where this is. The hardened dunes overlooking the Pacific Ocean just before sunset. Before me was a card table set up with a tablecloth, candles, two place settings. Oh, yes.
Guys, so, don't do this on your first date. Start slow, build up. Don't start the grand build up.
And I was going to say the guys should be taking notes because, like, this was the point of no return for me. So he lights the candles. He seats me. He turns on the tape recorder, which was the previously forgotten item. And it is crooning The Carpenters, our favorite, our favorite group. So nothing could be more perfect. The sun is now dripping down into the Pacific. People are jogging by looking like, what is this, a commercial they're filming? They keep on going. And Paul serves a salad. And he says, before you take a bite, I just need to tell you, I heard you say that you love avocados. I've never bought one. So when I went to the market to get one, I stood there in front of the avocados, and I didn't know if they were supposed to be soft or hard. So I did my best, and if it's not the right thing, I'm really sorry. Well, upon tasting one piece of avocado, it was confirmed that he did not know how to pick an avocado. It was hard and it was tasteless and it didn't matter. It didn't matter. I was just amazed that this guy had paid so much attention. He had collected that information, a passing comment. He had acted on it, and even though he didn't get it right, I got the heart behind the expression. And I want to just tell you that I wish I could stand before you and say that I have been as gracious in receiving missed moments ever since in our marriage. But there are times when Paul's best effort is met with, really? Like, who doesn't know how to pick an avocado? He's got the avocado thing down well, but there are just a whole lot of other things in life that he doesn't know. So, now let me just say, the reason I'm saying this is because it's not a great reflection on me. I feel like instead of seeing his heart behind his efforts, I don't always choose to do that. Sometimes I just give in to my own frustration, my disappointment, my who in the universe doesn't know that type of mind. And as a result, they become missed opportunities for us building into the friendship of our marriage.
We're staying in Sacramento, Granite Bay, with our son-in-law's parents. When we were, I think, at Thrive or something recently. And as a appreciation, we're at Costco, best store in the world, and we're going to get flour. I said, hey, Gabe, would your mom like some flowers? Would she appreciate that? And he said, oh, she would really love them. And so I was getting, and he said, unlike my wife, who couldn't stand if I gave her flowers. She sees that a whole waste. And I thought, wow, 5 years into marriage, and he's got it. He knows his mom likes cut flowers. He knows Carrie doesn't like cut flowers. See, are we students of each other? After 36 years of marriage, and fortunately it doesn't happen very often, but one of the most hurtful things Virginia says to me is, don't you even know me? When I do something or don't do something. And she says, this is who I am. Don't you even know that about me? So the first thing is be a student of your spouse. Second, do something about that. Act on those things you know are important to your spouse. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed. Now, what are those last four words? If you do them. No points for knowing everything about your spouse if you don't do anything. In fact, it's worse when your spouse knows what you want and you ignore that. And Jesus is saying to the disciples, now that you know all this stuff, you'll be blessed if you do it. It's the action there. We met with a couple who had been married for, 35 years, a doctor and his wife. And she is saying, we did the how cherished you feel on 1 to 10. She said, is 0 the lowest, that sort of thing. And we said, well, tell us why you don't feel cherished. And she said, well, my birthday is a really big thing to me. And my husband has never been home for my birthday. For 35 years, I've said, it would mean a whole lot to me if we could go out for my birthday or we could have dinner together. But he's a doctor, and every birthday he calls and says, hey, I'm sorry, a meeting came up, or I've got a patient to write, and he's never once been there for my birthday. Now, men are forgetful about some things, but one of the things about birthdays are they occur every year, and they occur on the same day every year. So this doctor, instead of just blocking this out, taking that day off, or, saying, I will take no appointments after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he just told his wife, sorry. How well do you think she's feeling cherished? Well, not at all. Did he know that about his wife? Absolutely. She said, I would really love it if you could, but he didn't do it at all. Some of you have heard us tell the story about Lou and Grace. They happened to be here with us this summer for a visit. There are a couple who are on our staff after they've been married for 30 years, and in our presence here in this cove, Lou told Grace for the first time in her hearing, I have never loved you in our marriage. It was a little awkward for us to be in the room when he shared that with her, but they split, and Grace stayed here and cooked for us. Lou went back to New Hampshire. They were apart for a year and a half. Long story, but by God's grace, they came back together, and we were with them at the Nutcracker Ballet. A year and a half later, 2 years later, after they got back together. Now, from a human standpoint, they shouldn't have ever gotten married. Lou was raised in orphanages, foster homes. He was a rough and tough kid. He was a big equipment diesel mechanic. He loved anything that was loud and dirty. He loved drag races, rodeos. This was Lou. Grace was Dutch. She liked tea parties. She liked quilting. She liked going to craft shows. Anything frilly, she liked. So from a human standpoint, they never should have been married, and that is true. But they were. They came back together. We're with them at the Nutcracker Ballet. It's intermission. I go up to Lou and look him in the face. I said, "So Lou, you like ballet, huh?" And he looked me in the eye and he said, "I love my wife." That's the right answer. Lou hated ballet. Lou thought about ballet like our daughter when we took her. "How'd you like the Nutcracker?" "Oh, it was okay, except for the dancing." But you see, Lou goes to ballet and to craft shows and to quilting shows, and Grace goes to drag races and to rodeos. Why? Because they like it? No, because they love each other. See, they know something, and they say, "I'm going to show you how much I love you by doing that." Now, they don't always go with each other, but if one says, "Hey, it'd really mean a lot to me if you could go with me," I can do that. And I'm sure women are just as guilty of this in different ways, but I can't tell you how many men just say, "Well, I'm not doing that. I'm not going shopping with her. Are you kidding?" Well, that's just a totally inappropriate response. We were with a pastor in Washington, the state of Washington. We had given a talk similar to this. At the end, he got up and he told us the story. He said, "When we moved to this coastal city, my wife said, 'I am so excited. I love walking on the beach.'" And he said, "Well, we'll buy a house close to the beach, but I hate the beach. So you need to know I will never walk with you on the beach. So let's just make it clear. Don't ever ask me. I will not walk on the beach, but I will buy a house close to the beach so you can walk the beach." After we talked, he got up in front of his congregation. He says, "I just have a commitment to make. I'm going to be walking on the beach today." Mm-hmm. Well, why? Because his wife loves walking on the beach. And that's part of this deal. It's really good, huh? You want to talk about anything else in this one? Okay. Point three, be intentional. Pursue common interests and focus. The two become one. They are no longer two. Are you working at oneness, which in early stages of relationship came so early, easily, or is that coming apart?
And so one of the things we want to challenge you to think back to the early days of your marriage or when you were falling in love with one another, what was it that drew you together? What did you like doing together? What were your common interests? Were there things that you pursued that you both really enjoyed? And very few people will look at us blankly when we ask that question and say, "Nope, there was nothing." All of you probably can come up with some things. We realize that with age and stage and different challenges in life, you may not be able to reproduce that list at this point in time. But the ongoing challenge of marriage is to make sure that you are pursuing common interests that keep drawing you together. That will help keep your marriage alive and growing.
And some couples will say, "But now we don't. When we got married, we both enjoyed the same things. But because of physical conditions or just different interests, we now don't enjoy the same things." So the modern marriage says, "Well, that's fine as long as you both do what you want to do." See, the problem with that is as long as we both do what we want to do, we are doing what we want to do with people that are other than our spouse, right? And it says the two become one, not you don't become one with these other people. And it's very easy for you to start to enjoy conversation out here because this person enjoys, you know, hiking and your spouse doesn't. And then, so you join a hiking club. And then you're hiking with this guy who says, "Doesn't your husband hike?" "No, he can't stand the outdoors." "Oh, that must be really tough." "Oh, yeah, it is. Oh, I bet you'd like, oh." And then you start talking about how horrible it is being married to Mr. Museum Lover or something, you know. And he's over at the museum talking to these women who say, "It must be hard to not be married to somebody who can appreciate art." See, you can't do that. If you start finding friendship with people other than your spouse of the opposite sex, you got to find a new hobby. because you are called to be one. So work hard, and we just have this as assignment. If you don't have anything right now you enjoy doing together, start brainstorming. You know, okay, maybe we like theater. Maybe we like, you know, taking walks. Do something together to build your life. Do not allow your special interests to be satisfied outside. You know, Ray inspired me by drawing, so I'm going to do this. You know, when you get married, here's a husband, and here's a wife, and it's wonderful, right? For just a little bit. Then, then something happens. Here's the husband, here's the wife, and what comes here? These little critters. And what do? They literally get between you, don't they? When you're hugging, and they try to separate you. And that's what Satan is using your kids. They're a tool of the devil to separate you. Okay? So there's the husband. There's the wife. You do all your vacations as a family. When you go out, if you ever do alone, what do you talk about? The children. Everything's about the children. And then they leave. And what happens? You're hanging. You're hung out to dry. And Satan has accomplished his work through your children. Children are great. We had three of them. We liked having them with us. We still have three. We like it when they're with us. But see, if children are what are holding you together, you're in deep weeds. Okay? Enough on that one. Number four, be committed. The covenant relationship is more than circumstances. We, Proverbs 17:17 says, a friend loves, what's that say? At all times. And a brother is born for adversity. You can put that in marriage. It fits. So when we counsel couples, when we started counseling some 30 years ago, we would very seldom see a couple before they'd been married for 7 or 8 years. Hardly ever. Now we regularly see couples who have been married for under a year, 2 or 3 years. Why? Circumstances. They're not what we thought. We're not happy. We're not fulfilled. We're not realizing our dreams. A covenant relationship is one that is for life.
So this is the framework for marriage, especially for you college students or you who are unmarried in the room, as you consider in your future entering this relationship. We beg you to take your cues from Scripture rather than from the culture. The culture exchanged the concept of covenant for contract, probably around the 60s. And that's really what opened the doorway into us becoming the divorce culture, to where now, in the year 2012, most 20-year-olds have lost confidence in marriage. But if they have any at all, it's that they can get married and they don't have to stay married unless it fulfills their expectations, unless it lives up to what they hoped they would get. And so rather than viewing it as a covenant, which is a lifelong commitment, that's what God calls us to, that's what gives us our security, you realize, in our relationship with God, is that He has established a covenant with us. And we love the security of that because we know it's a no matter what covenant. It's God's doing towards us. He's really intended the marriage relationship to be that strong for us. We enter that lifelong commitment, and we realize that in a room this size, there are some of you who have been really hurt by divorce, and sometimes divorce is the lesser of two evils. We totally get that. We live in a very broken world, and evil is pervasive, and sometimes situations are so unsafe that divorce is the lesser of two evils. The vast majority of people, however, break the covenant of marriage for much lesser reasons. And most of those reasons have to do with my own selfishness. My own expectations haven't been met. This marriage isn't really doing it for me. I'm really not feeling it. And so I'm going to go someplace else. And so for those of you who are not yet in the covenant, we just want you to be so convinced that God's design for the covenant is not restrictive and binding in the sense that it is oppressive. but that it is actually so for our benefit. I will tell you that not having the divorce word in our marriage for 36 years has given us tremendous freedom to continue to grow and to thrive and to become within the safety of this covenant commitment.
We were counseling a couple that came into us, and the man really initiated the session, which is unusual. It's usually the wife. But he wanted to demonstrate why he could leave the marriage, or at least hope that we would counsel his wife how wrong she was. And he said, "My wife will not have sex with me every other day, as she should, and she will not do whatever I ask her to do sexually. And if she really loved me, she would do both of those things. And I don't think that I need to stay in a marriage where I am married to somebody who is so selfish like that and will not meet my needs." I decided at that time I would share a little perspective with him. He got so angry, he literally was standing yelling at me. So we had this little, it's not very good counseling technique, but. So we're yelling at each other, and he's going to leave, and, you know, anyway, it's a longer story. So that ends that session. 3 days later, we got an email from somebody in response to when we spoke at Bayside a couple years ago. Was it last year? We at the end of a session, a gentleman came out and he said, "I really love what you said." He said, "I believe in everything you said about husband and wife loving each other, all of that." But he said, "My wife is mentally ill. And she struggles with severe depression. So she does not have the capability to respond as you have challenged the women. What do I do?" He says, "I'm committed to the marriage, but it is so, so hard." So we talked a little bit afterwards. Virginia and I talked, and she remembered a couple gentlemen that we know who have been in similar situations. She said, "Hey, why don't we write them and just see what advice they would give and if they'd be willing?" And they both so graciously responded immediately to this gentleman with long emails. But I want to read you just part of what one of the gentlemen wrote. He'd been married for 35 years to a woman who had been in and out of mental institutions, struggled with severe depression for most of the marriage. And this is just a little bit of what he wrote in the email to this gentleman. "And what God has called together, he doesn't want broken. I would be lying if I said that the word divorce never entered my mind, but it never really did enter my thinking. Vows are vows. In the dark night, sometimes our thoughts go to the idea that we might be better off if only we could flee the marriage. But in the morning, standing and staying is of God. And by staying, you have honored God in ways perhaps more noble and glorious than any of the Christian leaders you might deeply admire. Honoring your vow is a deep thing that God has asked of you and placed upon you. And by honoring it, you in your own small way have been helping God's kingdom come to life here on earth. Because a vow has been kept in a world that treats vows like tissue paper, easily shredded and torn. Kept vows build God's shalom like very little else does." There's an old story of an older missionary couple that came back to the States on a steamship after a long and faithful career of serving God invisibly and without much reward overseas. They were at the rail of the ship as it came to its berth, and there was much fanfare and commotion there on the dock to greet a famous dignitary who had been on the ship with us. The husband mumbled something to his wife about how they weren't getting any kind of a welcome or recognition. His wife paused a moment and said, "But honey, we're not home yet. One day you'll look Jesus in the eye and he will know what you have done, and he will look you in your eyes and whisper, 'Well done.' Not perfectly done. Lord knows how imperfectly I've handled this calling he has put upon me and the things I am ashamed of and the failures that I know and carry. But one day you'll be home and all things will be made right. One day, so keep hoping. This world is not all there is. This world is upside down. But one day your wife will be fully alive, and so will you. One day, so keep hoping." And listen to this. "As you live in the messiness of the present, keep hoping for the wonder of the future. It is beyond what you can imagine, So keep hoping. He's a hero of mine. One guy is ready to leave his wife because she won't have sex every other day. The other man has stayed faithful to his wife, who for who knows how many years hasn't been able to respond to him at all. Why? I made a vow. I made a commitment. And I did not let circumstance be the determiner of whether I would keep that vow.
And before we move on to the next point, I wonder how many of you heard the news story back in about October when Pat Robertson made the pronouncement that if an older couple, one person is failing with Alzheimer's, then it's probably reasonable for their spouse to divorce them. Anybody catch that? Okay, well, Google it when you go home. The response to that was outrage, and rightfully so. I mean, really, people said, are you kidding me, Pat Robertson? You must be smoking crack. Why in the world would you say such a thing? Why would you ever think that leaving a marriage because your spouse has Alzheimer's is an okay thing to do? So the outrage fit the crime. But I was very, very interested to hear Mark Gunger's response to this in a March article that he wrote on the internet. And he quoted the Pat Robertson debacle. And he said, rightfully, everyone was outraged at Pat Robertson's suggestion of leaving the covenant because of Alzheimer's. And he said, I agree with that 100%. But he said, every day around us, fully minded spouses are leaving their marriages for all manner of reasons. Where's the outrage? And I just think he leaves us with a really good question.
Fifth, be honest. No secret keeping in friendships. Ephesians 4:25 says, put away all falsehood and speak truth to each other.
Okay, so the big reason, you know why people are still getting married, even though the rates of cohabitation are higher than they've ever been in the history of record keeping, people are still getting married. I rode on a plane from Boston to San Diego last year in preparation for our Julie's wedding. The woman who was sitting next to me happened to be a wedding czar from New York, and she was going out to a big trade show in California. So she was talking on and on and on about the dress label she carries and all of the rest. And then she stopped and she said, what do you do? And I said, well, you know all those brides that you dress up? I said, we actually try to keep them married. And she said, that is a really good idea. She said, I've been married and divorced 3 times myself, and my 2 daughters have both been in and out of marriages. It's harder than it looks. And I thought to myself, but there are no shortage of people buying dresses from her salon or from anybody else's. The wedding industry is burgeoning. It is a multi-billion-dollar industry. Why? Why are people getting married with the crash and burn rate of marriages and with those who stay married, so many not really experiencing what they ever really thought they would have in marriage? Why do people still get married? Now, we'll just answer the question, and that's because God has placed that in our hearts. We were designed for relationship. We were designed for community, and marriage offers us the most intimate form of community we could ever experience on earth. That's why we long to get married. The very thing that we long for in marriage, to be intimately involved with another person. I'm not now talking about the sexual relationship. I'm talking about the soul relationship. We hear it all the way floating around our culture these days. I'm looking for my soulmate, right? And boy, if we find our soulmate, we've got it made. That's what we think. Sadly, many people think they found their soulmate after they got married to their non-soulmate, apparently. But that's what we want, is intimacy. But this is the key to intimacy: honesty and transparency. And so the very thing that we most want from marriage, we often sabotage because we're not committed to being honest with one another. One of the sessions we do at our pre-marriage workshop called Engagement Matters is on this topic of honesty. And we talk right out of Ephesians 4, be truthful, don't lie to one another. It's very, very clear in that passage. Several days after one of our weekends a couple years ago, well, a lot of years ago now, we got this lengthy email from one of the couples that attended. She starts off by saying, I was so uncomfortable during that session because she said, I was 3 months from my wedding date. I'd been waiting my whole life. She was like 29. She was marrying a guy that was about 32. She said, I've been waiting my whole life to find a godly man to marry, and I had him. And we were so happy, and everything was going along great, and then you gave that session. And she said, I sat there during that session, and my heart just kept dropping lower and lower into my stomach because there were some pretty big things that I'd never told him. Because I'd already laid him at the foot of the cross. It happened earlier in my 20s when I was unwise and I wasn't following Christ, and I knew that I was forgiven, and I didn't think there was any reason to let him know the things that he didn't already know. I mean, after all, it would probably hurt him to know. But she said, the more you talked and the more the Holy Spirit worked on my heart, because one of the things you said was this: you desperately need to know when you walk down that aisle that you're walking into a relationship in which someone is pledging to fully know you and still fully love you. That's the desire of our hearts when we get married. We don't marry somebody because they're perfect or because they think we're perfect. We marry them because they are willing to take on me with my warts and all and still love me in spite of that. And she said, I realized that if I was really honest with myself, I didn't want him to know because I was so afraid that if he knew, he wouldn't want to marry me. And can I just tell you that that's the weakest foundation upon which to build a marriage, to be hiding things that you are pretty sure that if this guy knows, he really wouldn't want to be married. So, she said, the conference ended on Sunday, and Sunday night, I said to him, we need to talk. And she said, this is probably going to be the hardest thing that I have to do, but I need to tell you some things that I have kept hidden from you. She said, I had tears streaming down my face, and I told him the things that I had done that were unbiblical actions that she had. I'm not talking about preferred things. I'm just talking, she had made some pretty big, big mistakes. And she said, I know that God has forgiven me, but I need you to forgive me also, but I also need you to know that I'm not going to hold you to marrying me if you don't think you can marry me now knowing this. She's crying, crying, crying. She doesn't even want to look up in his face. And then he takes her hands, and he lifts her chin, and he's got tears streaming down his face. And he said, well, there are some things I need to tell you also. And she said through his tears, he confessed the things that he hadn't wanted her to know. And at the end of that time, they both affirmed that they had been forgiven by the grace of God, that they were not the people that they were when they did those things, that they were committed to being Christ-like in their marriage, and that they wanted to move towards marriage, which they did. We married them 3 months later. They're now 15 years into marriage. They have 3 kids. They're making a difference for a kingdom, and God has worked so redemptively in their lives. But I want to tell you this. It would be a completely different story if that night had not happened for them.
Sixth, practice affirmation, be an encourager. Ray and Carol touched on this morning, how important encouragement is in the marriage relationship. Hebrews 3:13 says, but encourage one another. How often is that?
Daily.
Oh, daily. Wow, that's often. but encourage each other daily, as long as it's called today, which is sort of every day, right? So that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. It's so easy to quit encouraging each other. You know, I told you I loved you 40 years ago, and if anything changes, I'll let you know. That sort of thing, you know? No, we're called every day to encourage each other. What a great discipline. When you get up in the morning to think, how can I encourage my wife? How can I encourage my husband? Think actively about that. One of the things we're encouraging couples to do before they leave the house in the morning is say, is there anything I can do for you today that would lighten your load? Is there anything I do for you? Is there anything I could pray for you? And offer a word of affirmation to each other. Make a world of difference because we're connecting. We're affirming each other every day.
And you really have to be intentional about this. I'll just tell you, because when I get out of the bed in the morning, my to-do list is going in my mind, and the first thing I'm usually ready to say to Paul is what I need him to do, what he needs to do, what we need to do, why hasn't he done that? Oh, rah, rah. I know.
Occasionally that happens.
And so if we're not really intentional about that, I'm just going to tell you, our life will turn into logistical interchanges and little more than that. And slowly the affirmation within our marriage will die, which will make us more vulnerable to hearing affirmation outside of our marriage. It's actually said that we probably like about 80% in the person that we're married to, and there are 20% that we would really like to change. And that most of us spend 80% of our time in the 20%. And when we do, the 20% grows, and slowly we lose heart that we're ever going to be able to please the person that we're married to, and all of our hopes and dreams can really go down the tube in short order.
Let me say that after 36 years of marriage, there's nothing wrong with me that Virginia hasn't already pointed out. Now, don't feel bad about that. It's just there's no need for her to keep pointing it out. I know that already. But isn't that something we just, you know, if you want to inspire your child to change, just make sure every day you're on them, right? You're a failure. Why'd you fail? Why'd you fail? Why'd you fail? Boy, every child responds to that. Oh, thank you so much. I didn't know I was a failure. I'll do better. No. And we don't do that in marriage either. So be an encourager. We grow so much more through that. But then there's point number 7, which sounds a little bit like it's contradiction, but that's encourage growth so that you are better together. Proverbs 27:17 says, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Virginia and I know each other better than anybody else knows us. And with that knowledge, we can sharpen each other or we can stab each other. And when one of the things we have found in our marriage is how we take criticism or critique from each other is a good barometer of how we're doing in our marriage. If I really feel loved by Virginia, I know she's for me, she thinks I'm terrific, and she points something out, I tend to say thanks. Why? Because I know she's for me. But if we're not doing well, if we've been at each other, she can mention just this little thing. Why are you always so negative? Why can't I ever please you? The deal could be exactly the same. It's all, do we feel really loved by our spouse or not? The greatest quarterback that ever lived, Tom Brady. We actually were at a wedding. I was officiating at a wedding, and Tom Brady was one of the groomsmen a couple weeks ago. And so there's a story that I've been telling that I wanted to confirm with him. A little nervous, because sometimes when you get the real story, it's not as good as the one you've made up. But so I talked to him, and I said, I just want you to confirm this story. Because the story is that when he is in Marin, a Thomas Martinez, when he was in eighth grade, taught him how to pass. And from that point on, Thomas Martinez, even though he has gone through all these different coaches where he's played in high school and college and the NFL, Thomas Martinez has always been his passing coach. And after every game, Thomas Martinez would call him and tell him what he did wrong. He would critique him. Or Tom would call Thomas, and he would critique him. And he loved it every time. And I said, is that true? He said, that's absolutely true. And I said, why is it true? He said, because I knew Thomas was for me. He wanted to make me better. He was on my side. He was totally sold out for me. Now, other people could criticize, and it wouldn't be taken the same way. And I thought, isn't that true in marriage? When we're convinced that our spouse is for us, that they're trying to help us grow, the two are becoming better together, then we take criticism, we take critique. But when we're not encouraging each other, when we're not building each other, and then we mention something, it just drives us apart. Last point, grow old and enjoy the memories together. Good friends grow old together, they still enjoy each other, and that's really how it should be. I don't think there's anything I enjoy more than seeing an older couple enjoying each other, an older married couple, walking hand in hand or just smiling or talking. And you can tell those couples that have built into their marriage. Many of you have heard us talk over the years. We've talked about Claude and Forrestine Cole. They're the 80-year-old couple who chased each other around naked after one of our talks. And
at their home.
At their home, yeah. We weren't there. They just told us about it. But anyway, Forrestine died maybe 3 years ago, and Claude died this last year. And I did his funeral in January, I think it was. one day, Forestine had Alzheimer's near the end of her life, and we're out of town a lot, and Claude told us, you know, Forestine often says, couldn't we go see Paul in Virginia? And she'd just keep asking. So he said, we'd get in the car, and we'd drive by your house. And I'd say, Forestine, they're not home. I'm so sorry. And so one day, we're home. And so knock on the door, and they came in, and we're talking, and they're leaving. And Forestine was upstairs talking to Virginia still. I was downstairs with Claude, getting ready to go out. And Forestine had been with her daughter for a week, the week before. I knew that. And I said, Claude, I bet it was really a relief to have Forestine gone this last week. And in all the years Claude and I have been close friends, it's the only time he ever snapped at me. He said, not at all. Don't say that. I missed her so much. And why did he miss her? Because they had developed a friendship over 64 years. Didn't matter whether she had Alzheimer's or not. I told this buck naked story, and it's the last story in Before You Save the Date. And when the book came out, I went over to Claude and I said, hey Claude, I got something to read to you. So I read the whole story, and I said, everywhere we speak in the United States, we tell the story about you chasing Forestine buck naked around your house. And I wish you could have been there. It was like a holy moment. He just sort of rolled back in his easy chair and just sort of reminisced. And I don't know what all he was thinking, but he was thinking about good times with Forestine. And I thought, that's because they worked on friendship for 64 years, and that's what we want. Hmm.
I hope that all of you have somebody's marriage that you're watching as they live out their golden years together. I hope that all of you have somebody who is setting for you a standard, who's setting the bar for how you want to your life together to go out of this world. We're supposed to have Garth and Rosemary come on Sunday. Some of you know Garth and Rosemary. Garth will celebrate his 90th birthday in October. And they've been such a huge inspiration to all of our staff for so many years because they just really love each other. Just before we came to camp this year, we spent a little bit of time with my parents. They'll celebrate their 68th anniversary on August 16th. And my dad is probably 10 years easily in the journey of some form of dementia, so there's not nearly a lot of him there. But my mom's still able to take care of him at home, and he's still, you know, mobile and that sort of thing. But I've thought a lot about the ending of their life. I don't think it's anything what my mom ever pictured it being. My dad was a naval officer. He's a retired admiral. He's a very, very, very intentional man and lived his life very, very well. I don't think they ever saw him ending his life in the state that he is. But I've thought about a lot about why are they reaching their 68th year of marriage together and ending well in spite of really, really difficult circumstances. And it really takes me back to my childhood. My father had many deployments back to back out of San Diego. We were stationed there for years upon years because I was one of seven children. My father said the Navy couldn't afford to move us. I don't know if that's true, but he got a lot of billets out of San Diego. When my father was deployed, and it would be from anywhere from 7 months at a time to 12 months at a time, and during the Vietnam era, I was in junior high school, and he was gone for 32 out of 36 months. But my parents, who married at 18 and 20, my mom came from a non-Christian home and came to Christ through meeting my dad, and my dad was a pastor's son, but thoroughly inexperienced, had no idea what marriage was going to be like. 4 months into marriage, get pregnant with their first child, so a year and 1 month into marriage, they are already parents. I mean, you know, you just think of these things. We're thinking from a marriage counselor standpoint. We would have told them, what are you thinking? Anyway, this is the image that I have. Every time my father was deployed, every single night, I would go in to kiss my mom goodnight. She would be sitting at our dining room table, which was a large mahogany table that my parents had built together because they couldn't find one large enough for our family. And she would be sitting there with a Mead writing tablet. They still have them in CVS, the orange covered. You know what I'm talking about? People actually used to write. My mom would sit there with her Mead tablet, and she would write my dad pages every single night. At the end of her letter, she would fold it up, and she would put it into an envelope that she had pre-addressed and pre-numbered. Because she knew that my father would only get mail once or twice a month. He'd be out at sea and they would do a mail drop, and then he'd get 14 letters at a time. And in order for him to know how the order in which to read them, and if any were missing, she would just chronologically arrange her letters. While she was doing that, my father, wherever he was in the world, was doing the exact same thing. And so when the mailman, about twice a month, would bring this bonanza of mail, we knew not to bother my mom for hours because she would be having a visit with my dad through mail. And I don't know what's in those letters, but I will just tell you, I've thought many times about what sacrifice it took for both of my parents to fulfill this commitment to one another. They weren't texting each other, shockingly. That wasn't happening then. They couldn't dash off an email. They couldn't pick up a phone and call. Letter was their medium. I asked my mom recently, because remember I said that she was the mother of seven children, and the oldest was 12 when the seventh was born. So it wasn't like my mom had a lot of time for eating bonbons. And I want to tell you that I've put myself in her position and thought, when I got the last little rascal in bed, I would flop on the couch, get some ice cream or something, Good Housekeeping magazine or a show to tune out on, but I certainly wouldn't do one more thing that served and loved someone else. So I asked her recently, I said, how did you do that? You must have had a million reasons not to write Daddy every single night. And she said, it was the best time of my day. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, because I was talking to your dad. And she said, that is what kept our marriage alive, though we were separated for so many months of our now 68 years of marriage. She said, your father and I were fulfilling our love and serving one another by writing letters to each other. You know, I've thought about that so much because I think it has so much to do with today for them. They are going to have their 68th anniversary, and it's not going to look anything like they probably envisioned when they celebrated their 60th, when my dad was much more with it. And I've asked my mom, how do you do it? It's just exhausting. She is exhausted from taking care of my dad, even though we're bringing in extra help, and I have sisters that are helping, and it's kind of thankless. My dad does not know who my mom is. And she said, I still love your dad. And she said, even though there's not as much in it for me now, your dad loved me so well for all the years that he could. I could do no less for him now. And so we want to close on that as kind of an inspiration for you to consider, how are you going to end? What legacy are you going to leave? I feel like Paul and I had such rich legacies in both of our sets of parents, and our children are hugely impacted as they watch their grandparents live out a commitment that goes way beyond the circumstances and the comfort of their life.
That's right. Father, thank you again for this idea you had called marriage. Thank you for giving us your word and how practical it is. And Father, will you help us to really be intentional in keeping our marriage a high priority as we love each other? In Christ's name.